Welcome to Feminist for Mothers, a Mama Film podcast. I'm your host, Emily Christensen. You're listening to a series about the cultural legacies of three complicated women: Carrie Nation, Hattie McDaniel, and Rosie the Riveter. Each made history, sure, but they still exert influence in surprising ways. And I think each of us can find something useful to take from their stories. Episode 1, The Notorious Carrie Nation. If you're not from Kansas, you probably haven't heard of her. But at the dawn of the 20th century, Carrie Nation was one of the most famous women in the world, both celebrated and reviled for smashing up bars with her trusty hatchet. Before we get started, I want to tell you a little bit about Mama Film. In 2019, Lila Mette O'Connor brought independent movies by and about women to her microcinema in Wichita, Kansas. Since then, she's collaborated on initiatives such as the Repro Film Festival and the Mothership Screenwriters Lab. Now, Mama Film is an official satellite screen for the 2021 Sundance Film Festival. From January 28th to February 2nd, you can catch screenings of 11 official Sundance selections at Wichita's Starlight Drive-In. Part of this collaboration includes original Beyond Film content, including the podcast you are listening to right now. Learn more and purchase tickets at mama.film. I've lived in Wichita, Kansas for more than 20 years. I don't remember the first time I heard about Carrie Nation, but it couldn't have been long after I arrived. Carrie never lived here, but Wichita was most definitely the birthplace of her notoriety. On December 27th, 1900, she paid a visit to the bar in the Carey Hotel, one of the city's fanciest drinking establishments. Here's what happened, according to a prohibitionist newspaper. On the day before her attack, she visited 9 joints and warned them that she would smash things on the following day if they did not quit their unlawful business. The day arriving, she visited the saloon in the Hotel Carey, threw a stone through the glass covering a life-size picture of a nude woman, knocked the decanter from the bar, and smashed a large plate glass mirror. Carrie managed to do $3,000 worth of damage before she moved on to target another saloon. In today's dollars, that's more than 90 grand. Eventually, she was arrested and charged with destruction of property. The building where Carrie conducted her raid still stands. A few years after her ambush, the name changed to the Eaton Hotel. Allen Ginsberg was the guest there in 1966, and he referenced both the hotel and Carrie Nation in his poem Wichita Vortex Sutra. The poem connects Carrie's, quote, vortex of hatred to the violence of the Vietnam War. Like so many men before him, Ginsberg didn't understand Carrie at all, nor did he bother to try. Around the turn of the 21st century, a developer converted the hotel rooms to apartments, and for a couple years in my mid-20s, I lived in a one-bedroom on the 5th floor. The building, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, occupies a full city block on Douglas Avenue. It's just a few steps from Old Town, a bar and entertainment district. In Kansas, Carrie's influence endures. Her cultural inheritance includes Wichita-based band Carrie Nation and the Speakeasy, which borrowed her name. Artist Wayne White created a 10-foot-tall Carrie puppet that stomped around downtown as part of the 2015 Wichita River Festival Sundown Parade. And a few years ago, Babs Meller's bronze life-size statue of Carrie was installed on Douglas, right outside the Eaton. In her contemporary biography of Carrie Nation, Fran Grace writes that no one really wants to claim Carrie. As a holy roller who campaigned for a lost cause, she holds minimal appeal for contemporary feminists. As a woman who forced herself into male-dominated spaces, she isn't a great fit for religious conservatives either. When I began researching Carrie for this podcast, I only knew the outline of her story. The caricature, the sly reference, a statue. My investigation took me places I didn't expect, including Chrissy Teigen's Instagram feed, the women's suffrage movement, sobriety memoirs, and Mad Max Fury Road. I guess the result of all this is that I'm prepared to claim Carrie. And not just because of her colorful story or local connection. Carrie Nation was as weird and brash as warm and windswept as the place I've learned to call home. To paraphrase Walt Whitman, she is vast. She contains multitudes. Part 1. Chrissy Teigen Quit Drinking. In late December, celebrity cookbook author and American treasure Chrissy Teigen posted a goofy Instagram video of herself singing and dancing. One of her 33.7 million Instagram followers commented, "I need whatever drugs you're on." Teigen replied with 4 words and 4 emoji. 4 weeks sober, double heart, prayer hands, double heart, prayer hands. Later, Teigen revealed that she stopped drinking after reading the book Quit Like a Woman by Holly Whitaker, a feminist recovery memoir slash guide. On an Insta story, Teigen wrote, "I was done with making an ass of myself in front of people. I'm still embarrassed. Tired of day drinking and feeling like shit by 6, not being able to sleep." Teigen had been thinking about the toll alcohol was taking on her life for at least a few years. In 2017, she told fashion magazine Marie Claire that she was working to moderate her intake. Teigen wasn't the kind of person you'd consider a problem drinker. But according to researchers, a lot of us drink too much. About 18% of Americans, according to the CDC. Kansas is just under the national average. About 1 in 6 of us are excessive drinkers. In modern life, conversation about alcohol's negative consequences centers around addiction, and for good reason. Alcohol can have devastating consequences on the lives of addicts and the people around them, but all excessive drinkers put themselves at risk of a range of negative health outcomes, from cancer and chronic illness to becoming the victim of a crime. And about 90% of excessive drinkers are not addicted to alcohol. Holly Whitaker and many others argue that we need to talk more about this much larger group. Many of us are heavier drinkers than we probably realize. The Dietary Guidelines for Americans define moderate alcohol consumption as up to 1 drink a day for women and up to 2 drinks a day for men. And if you're anything like me, a drink may be a lot smaller than you think. The USDA says it's equivalent to 12 fluid ounces of regular beer, 5 fluid ounces of wine, or 1.5 fluid ounces of 80-proof distilled spirits. The higher alcohol content in a stout or double IPA might rate it as 1.5 or even 2 servings. 5 ounces of wine is approximately 2/3 of a cup, which is 1 ounce shy of a typical restaurant pour. It turns out the only way to rosé all day in moderation is to have a single shot of wine at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Anyway, back to Chrissy Teigen, whose enormous celebrity can trigger an avalanche of entertainment news items with a single social media post. Her Instagram book review created an immediate demand for Quit Like a Woman. Just 4 days after she mentioned it, the book hit the Amazon charts as the number 4 best-selling book for the week of January 3rd. A couple weeks later, it made the New York Times bestseller list for the first time. Quit Like a Woman is a little bit difficult to describe. It's part memoir, part dire warning, part social commentary, part recovery guide, all with a healthy dose of feminism. Here's a typical passage. Drinking has become so ingrained in the female code, we don't even recognize the nearly endless ways it's pierced our every experience, or even stop to think about the cost of that infiltration. Wine and spirits and even beer are a celebrated, quintessential accessory to having made it as a woman. Whitaker isn't the first feminist to criticize alcohol and the role that it plays in women's lives. In 1979, media critic Jean Kilbourn released her first documentary, Killing Us Softly, Advertising's Image of Women. My introduction to Kilbourn's work was her 1999 book, Can't Buy My Love, How Advertising Changes the Way We Think and Feel. Parts of it feel a bit dated now, but the book still stands up as an important work of media criticism. In a chapter titled, Forget the Rules, Enjoy the Wine, Kilbourn writes about how the alcohol industry targets women with the theme of liberation, a tactic it has deployed for decades. She uses a Chivas Royal ad from the mid-70s as an example. The copy reads, "Now that you're bringing home the bacon, don't forget the Chivas." The image is a beautiful, beringed hand plucking a bottle of scotch off the liquor store shelf. Liberated women in alcohol advertising are also attractive and successful, of course. They have it all, in part because they have a drink in their hand. Kilbourn also points out that the alcohol industry profits from binge drinkers and heavy users. If every adult American drank at the safe level according to federal guidelines, alcohol industry sales would be cut by 80%. As one researcher said, though problem-free drinking does exist for great numbers of people, it's at such small levels that it would sustain only a fraction of the present alcohol beverage industry. This might not be such a big deal if excessive drinking didn't have such enormous public health consequences. Research shows consumption increases risky behaviors and violent crime. Alcohol is a factor in more than half of reported sexual assaults and incidents of domestic violence, crimes that disproportionately victimize women. Like Kilbourn, Caroline Knapp discusses the relationship between drinking and sexual assault in her 1996 memoir, Drinking, A Love Story. The book describes her recovery, but it's also an exploration of why she became an addict in the first place. Among the many reasons is what she calls the discomfort of being female, the constant ogling, catcalls, and small violations of her body. 20 years after Knapp's memoir, Christy Coulter authored a viral Medium post about her own reasons for drinking and then not drinking. She wrote, "There's no easy way to be a woman, because there's no acceptable way to be a woman. And if there's no acceptable way to be the thing that you are, maybe you drink a little. Or a lot." The essay is included in Coulter's 2018 collection, Nothing Good Can Come of This. The book is part of a publishing boomlet of recovery literature authored by women. Many of these books echo the same theme. Drinking isn't a means of liberation for women, and it may just be the opposite. Coulter wrote, "Booze is the oil in our motors, the thing that keeps us purring when we should be making other noise." Many decades ago, another group of ladies surveyed the landscape and decided that alcohol wasn't great for women. They were called prohibitionists, but they were also proto-feminists. It's just the methods that have changed. Modern-day temperance feminists rage against alcohol using media criticism, memoir, and recovery. Prohibitionists use political organizing and sometimes destruction of property. That brings us back to Carrie Nation. Part 2. Hatchetation. Carrie arrived in Kansas in 1889, having yet again followed her husband to a new town where he hoped to find success. She was a 28-year-old widow with a young child when she met and married David Nation. He was nearly 50. It's very likely that Carrie viewed her second marriage as a means of survival, not exactly rom-com material. David was a newspaperman slash lawyer slash minister, but he often struggled to make a living. A few years into their marriage, the Nations moved from Missouri to South Texas to become cotton farmers. They didn't have enough money, and they didn't really know what they were doing. So David moved to town to work as a lawyer, and eventually Carrie began running a hotel. Carrie's only vocational experience was in the classroom. In Missouri, she'd worked as a teacher after her first husband died. Operating a public business wasn't exactly a respectable vocation for a woman of her time, but Carrie didn't really have a choice. She and David were on the brink of total financial ruin. In addition to her business pursuits, Carrie became active in the town's churches, teaching Sunday school and organizing charity groups. She was doing well when David decided they needed to move again. This established a pattern that continued throughout their marriage. Against all odds, Carrie finds success. After a while, David insists they move. The Nations start over, and Carrie becomes a pillar of their new community. Eventually, David wants to pull up stakes again. Rinse, lather, repeat. It was almost as though David couldn't stand the fact that his wife was a better moneymaker, a better leader, and even a better preacher than he. But if David was in search of a community that would appreciate him more than Carrie, he doesn't seem to have found it. In Texas, Carrie experienced a religious awakening. She felt that God spoke to her directly and that she had the authority to interpret the Bible herself. After the local churches booted her from their Sunday school classrooms, Carrie organized her own version of a church at her hotel. After her awakening, she became even more devoted to helping her neighbors, regardless of their station in life. Later on, Carrie became friends with Topeka minister Charles Sheldon, who coined a phrase that will sound very familiar if you attended church youth group in the 90s, WWJD, What Would Jesus Do? Sheldon admired Carrie's boldness, but her disregard for Victorian propriety ticked off many of her fellow Christians, including her husband. In the divorce papers David Nation filed many years later, he complained that she gave away his property to the poor. Classroom experience, business success, church leadership, and a spiritual awakening all combined to make Carrie Nation an unusually confident woman when she arrived in Medicine Lodge, Kansas. She joined the Women's Christian Temperance Union, an organization that advocated for the prohibition of alcohol, the right for women to vote, and other social reforms. Thanks to the WTCU and the Kansas Equal Suffrage Association, Kansas women earned municipal suffrage in 1887. In the first election where women could vote, Susanna Salter became the mayor of Argonia, Kansas. She was the first woman in the country to hold this position. Around the same time, the WTCU successfully lobbied to raise the age of consent to 18 from the age of 10. That's right, 10. When the Nations arrived in Kansas, the state was still a hotbed of progressivism. Its citizens believed they lived in a new promised land, a shining example for the rest of the country. Carrie felt that she herself had been called by God to do his work in the world, so Kansas suited her perfectly. In 1880, Kansas was the first state to ban liquor, and its citizens considered this measure its gift to the nation. However, the law was barely enforced. Saloons stayed in business, often thanks to a bribery system that lined the pockets of judges and lawmen. Behind the saloon door, men did business, cut political deals, and gambled their money away. Often they returned home to terrorize their families. Drinking represented women's lack of power, both in public life and in their homes. It's no wonder that women fought for prohibition. They did so largely through political activism, and the most influential prohibitionist organization was the WTCU. When she arrived in Kansas, Carrie was already a formidable leader, but the WTCU taught her how to be an activist. Carrie also had personal reasons to join the prohibitionists. Her first husband, Charles Gloyd, literally drank himself to death less than 2 years after their wedding. Before the WTCU, Carrie blamed Charlie's death on his weak character. Now she understood her private tragedy was part of a larger systemic problem. After a while, she was no longer satisfied with confronting saloon keepers and singing hymns outside liquor joints. She and a few of her WTCU pals smashed a barrel of whiskey in the middle of the street, but even that felt like a half measure. No one else bothered to uphold the law, so Carrie decided to take matters into her own hands. Wichita wasn't the first stop on Carrie's bar-smashing tour. She had a trial run on a smaller stage, the town of Kiowa. Carrie felt led there by God, and she went alone. She brought a bag full of rocks that she wrapped in paper so they looked like packages. Her Kiowa saloon raid caused a local stir. By the time Carrie smashed up 3 bars and made the return trip to Medicine Lodge, telegrams had notified the locals about what she was up to. National papers picked up the story after Carrie's Wichita raid. Eastern cartoonists and newspaper men couldn't resist this kooky Midwestern character. Some speculated that her crusade had its origins in her sexual repression, or perhaps menopause. Yep, back in 1900, men were already blaming women's transgressive behavior on their reproductive systems. To the delight of journalists around the world, Carrie didn't quit after her raid on the bar at the Hotel Carrie. She smashed up a couple more Wichita bars after her release from the Sedgwick County Jail. She left a trail of destruction behind her in Enterprise, Kansas. Then she took her crusade to the capital city of Kansas. Before, Carrie had operated without much in the way of backup. In Topeka, she assembled an army. Carrie arrived there just in time for the state temperance convention. Before an adoring crowd, she uttered these words, "I tell you, ladies, you don't know how much joy you will have until you begin to smash, smash, smash. It is wonderful." Thousands of women and men answered Carrie's call to agitate and chop, an activity she called hatchetation. They called themselves the Home Defenders Army, and they were ultra serious. They formed units and practiced drills. Carrie's followers saw her as a modern-day John Brown, the Kansas abolitionist. He was hanged for treason after his pre-Civil War attempt to lead an insurrection of enslaved people. By the time that she arrived in Topeka, Carrie had escaped two lynch mobs. She and her followers were keenly aware of the risks they were taking when they led a weeks-long campaign of destruction against the liquor merchants of Topeka. The Home Defenders felt they were within their rights to enforce the law, especially when women were still mostly shut out of the political process. Later, in an address to the Kansas State Legislature, Carrie said, "You refused me the vote, so I had to use a rock." Carrie quickly amassed followers because she was different from how she was portrayed in the media. She was forceful for sure, but she was also warm and charismatic. She disarmed saloon keepers and their patrons by appealing to them in a direct yet grandmotherly way. "Boys, boys, if you get into trouble, all you have to do is tell Mother Nation, and she'll be around." In Topeka, Carrie's natural affinity for marketing created a thriving souvenir trade. She contracted with a Rhode Island company to make Carrie Nation-branded hatchet pins to sell at rallies and on street corners. The pins were so popular that Carrie and her supporters expanded into a whole line of merchandise, from signed photos to Home Defender buttons to water bottles. She was so notorious that everyone wanted a memento, even if they disagreed with Carrie's cause or her tactics, although she did use the proceeds to pay for bail and lawyers. When I was first learning about Carrie, I didn't quite grasp her timeline. Her first Wichita smash-up happened at the end of December. By February, she'd assembled an army of thousands, addressed the Kansas legislature, and hit the lecture circuit. Not long after, she released the first issue of the Smashers' Mail, which published both her prohibitionist rhetoric and her hate mail. As always, Carrie Nation demonstrated an almost superhuman ability to get things done, as well as an excellent sense of timing. She went on to found another magazine, The Hatchet, write a surprisingly readable autobiography, and open a home for women and children of alcoholics, a kind of early domestic violence shelter. She traveled the world and toured with vaudeville shows. A play based on her story launched the Broadway career of actor Jimmy Stewart. She was also arrested 30 times. She was a badass. Carrie achieved some of her goals, too. The Kansas legislature strengthened prohibition laws in response to her raids. Women responded to her crusade by turning out to vote in municipal elections in record numbers. Carrie died several years before the country saw both prohibition and women's suffrage, though she undoubtedly contributed to both. Supposedly, her last words were, "I did what I could." The more I read about Carrie, the more I grew to like her. I wanted to do her justice when telling her story. This task proved to be a bit stressful because there's so much misinformation out there. Some of it is based in misogynist critiques of Carrie during her time. One example is a short silent film released by Thomas Edison's production company in 1901. It portrays David Nation, left at home to care for a child and driven to drink by his domineering wife. It reflected the anxiety that liberated women would abandon their household responsibilities and emasculate their husbands. It took me some time to figure out how to spell her first name, even. They sound exactly the same, but on legal documents throughout the first part of her life, she was Carrie Amelia, C-A-R-R-I-E. After she became a temperance reformer, she legally changed her name to Carrie A. Nation, C-A-R-R-Y, because she was determined to carry a nation into prohibition. Nevertheless, it's common to see Carrie's name with the more traditional I-E spelling. In my opinion, when a grown person goes to the trouble of changing their name, legally or otherwise, we should respect that. So it's Carrie, C-A-R-R-Y. Thank goodness for Fran Grace, a religious studies professor at the University of the Redlands. This podcast relies heavily on her 2001 biography of the Kansas activist. I bought my copy at the Stockade Museum in Medicine Lodge. The museum's grounds include the Carrie Nation home, where Carrie and David lived together before their divorce. The recently established gift shop also sells postcard reproductions of the massive portrait that hangs in Carrie's home, as well as reproduction home defender buttons. The museum attendant who checked me out was a young woman wearing a t-shirt that said, "Strong Female Lead." Part 3. The Battle Axe on Screen. Throughout history, men have wielded battle axes, but they can't be them. Without exception, battle axes are women. This archetype may have originated with the Celtic queen, Boudica, whose name I'm probably mispronouncing. In the early days of the Common Era, Boudica led an uprising against the Roman Empire. The term has evolved to mean a usually older woman who is sharp-tongued, domineering, or combative. That's according to Merriam-Webster. The hatchet-wielding Carrie Nation certainly embodies this archetype in more ways than one. Some of the most memorable women on screen have been battle axes. Although, Hollywood being what it is, and has always been, they are rarely older women. Think of Sigourney Weaver's Ripley in the 1979 sci-fi horror flick Alien, Susan Sarandon's Louise in the 1991 road movie Thelma and Louise, Uma Thurman's Bride in 2003's Kill Bill. But for my money, the ultimate movie battle axe is Charlize Theron's Imperator Furiosa in Mad Max Fury Road, which hit theaters in 2015. Fury Road is the fourth installment of the Mad Max series, which is set in an elaborate, dystopian wasteland. The protagonist of all four movies is Max Rokitansky, an ex-cop and current road warrior. But Imperator Furiosa is the character at the center of Fury Road. Kidnapped as a child, Furiosa is now the chief commander of a Morton Joe's war squad. She is, in fact, his only female warrior. Most of the other women under Joe's dictatorial rule are essentially cattle, kept around only to pump breast milk. At the beginning of Mad Max Fury Road, Furiosa is headed out in her war rig with a tanker of mother's milk to trade for other provisions. Instead, she changes course. We soon learn her real mission, to ferry a Morton Joe's five wives far away, to someplace safe, outside of his grasp. Not unlike upper-class white women in the Victorian era, the wives live in luxurious captivity in exchange for performing their social role, bearing children, and most importantly, sons. Like Carrie Nation, Furiosa is able to rally both men and women to her cause. Unlike Carrie, she's a woman of few words.
How does it feel? It hurts. Out here, everything hurts. You want to get through this? Do as I say. Now pick up what you can and run.
Nevertheless, Furiosa is motivated to protect these women. Her determination to do so is what most reminds me of Carrie Nation. Like Carrie, she attracts an interesting crew, a defector from the War Boys, a quartet of older women warriors, and of course Max himself. You could almost call them the Home Defenders Army. Though I love a strong female character, Mad Max Fury Road is not really my kind of movie. And what will surely be a blow to my tough lady image, I have to admit that I can't stand watching on-screen violence of any kind, even when it's only implied. Watching Fury Road, albeit with my hands partially covering my eyes, convinced me that I'm missing out. There's something profoundly affecting in watching a woman fully occupy a traditionally masculine role, even a violent one. Charlize Theron has explored this territory over and over in her career, including in the movie Old Guard, in which she swings a literal battle axe. For its July 2020 Heroes issue, Entertainment Weekly included an interview with Theron about her attraction to fierce characters. She said that as a child, she was drawn to heroic TV figures such as MacGyver and Knight Rider, all men, of course. Alien was released when she was 4 years old, but she didn't see Sigourney Weaver's performance until her early 20s. Theron said, "Once I saw her be Ripley, it was like the world opened up and it just felt limitless." Not only are battle axes like Ripley heroic, they're complicated and imperfect. In this way, they're far more human than most of the women we see on screen. Theron went on to say, "What we think a female warrior or female hero or female action star should look like is not necessarily the truth. There's something to celebrate in the complexities of our faults and our flaws and all of the things that make us interesting. We can fight and save the world and make a mess. We can just live and breathe and be." When I read this, I thought of Carrie immediately. There's something to celebrate in the complexities of her faults and all her flaws and all of the things that made her interesting. She fought to save the world, and she often made a mess. There's liberation in that. At the end of Fury Road, Furiosa takes her fight to Immortan Joe himself. In this decisive scene, she delivers a line I can imagine Carrie Nation hurling at a saloon keeper who ignored her warnings.
"Remember me?"
Interlude. Follow, unfollow, or pause for 30 days. I can't stop thinking about whether or not Carrie Nation would be good on social media, and if so, whether she would be worth a follow. To the first question, well, obviously. As a formidable crafter of catchphrases, Carrie would be a compelling Twitter user and or modern-day meme lord. The quick-witted activist used to greet bartenders by saying, "Good morning, destroyer of men's souls." She once called a judge who opposed her "your dishonor," which is a quality burn. She also had a unique personal style, which artist Hannah Scott captured in her illustration for this podcast. Carrie rejected corsets, feathers, and fine fabrics in favor of a more severe, almost androgynous look. I can almost visualize her fashion TikTok videos. Sunday style tip: wear your purse around your waist to keep your hands free to swing a hatchet or throw a rock. But is Carrie worth a theoretical follow? At this point, it shouldn't be any surprise to you that I would be engaged with her across all platforms. We certainly part ways on many issues, but I love a good iconoclast. Carrie was intensely committed to women's rights. She believed women should have bodily autonomy at a time and in a place where that idea was shocking. You gotta love that. Plus, hatchetations would make for extremely compelling live video. But I can think of at least 5 reasons you might want to unfollow Carrie, or maybe just pause or mute for a while. For starters, she had all the worst white feminist flaws. Sure, she didn't have the same rights as a white man, but she was also far more privileged than Black and Indigenous Americans. She managed to escape death at the hands of bar owners, lynch mobs, and the law, partly through her enormous charisma. But being a middle-class, respectable white lady made her activism possible in the first place. Along the same lines, Carrie was kind of the judgiest. She was quick to offer help to those in need, but sometimes that came with a heaping dose of "I know what's good for you." Reading about Carrie's good works reminded me a little bit of a line by writer Anne Lamott. Sometimes help is the sunny side of control. She was big on self-denial, too. In contrast, many contemporary activists embrace pleasure as central to liberation. For an introduction to this concept, see Adrienne Marie Brown's 2019 book, Pleasure Activism: The Politics of Feeling Good. Carrie was also a big-time street preacher. So if you're the kind of person who desperately tries to avoid eye contact with the guy giving out free Bibles, you're probably not going to have a great experience with Carrie Nation's very long Facebook sermons. Lastly, her big issue was prohibition. All the problems with that approach could easily fill an entire podcast series. Some might actually be justified in blocking Carrie entirely, because when you think about it, she would definitely engage in an online harassment campaign against everyone from bartenders to brewery owners. On the other hand, her feed just might be a great source of inspo for the newly or temporarily sober. Epilogue, Dry January. More and more Americans are trying to stop drinking. Others simply practice sobriety during the first month of the calendar year, a trend called Dry January. Of course, when a consumer door closes, the invisible hand of the market opens a window, right? I'm recording this episode shortly after the new year, when you can find oodles of newly published reviews of booze-free beer, wine, and even distilled spirits. Drinks can carry the non-alcoholic label as long as they contain less than 0.5% of alcohol by volume. Athletic Brewing Company holds the biggest share of the NA craft beer market. Their sales increased by 500% in 2020. I was more than a little bit skeptical when I ordered a sampler pack, but I have to say, Athletic's extra dark and Mexican-style copper are shockingly good. Other than the lack of alcohol, they taste exactly like a good craft beer. Even Wichita-based Koch Industries isn't on the game. Last year, one of their subsidiaries launched a new business to help reduce the amount of alcohol in non-alcoholic products. According to a story in the Wichita Business Journal, the technology can guarantee below 0.02%. Many bars and restaurants have expanded their cocktail menus to accommodate sober customers. Two of Wichita's best cocktail bars serve liquor-free libations, which is how they're listed on the menu at Cana Wine and Cocktails. There, you can sink into a velvet-upholstered sofa and order a faux loma, Cana's version of a paloma mixed without tequila. At Dockham's Speakeasy, which occupies an old bank vault in the basement of the Ambassador Hotel, zero-proof drinks are listed on the menu under the label Preventatives. These drink recipes skip the booze, but they use other craft cocktail ingredients, such as egg whites and house-made bitters or syrups. Local bars are beginning to offer substitutes for liquor, too. Non-drinkers can sip Apollo Fermentations kombucha at Central Standard Brewing. The locally produced fermented drink is even on tap at my favorite dive bar, the legendary Kirby's Beer Store. I spent large parts of my 20s and 30s at Kirby's, playing dominoes and euchre and the jukebox, listening to live music and drinking vodka sodas, or boxed wine, or tap beer. It was only after reading Caroline Knapp's Drinking a Love Story a few years ago that I realized how immoderate my own drinking habits were. That's when I learned a single serving of alcohol is so very small. I decided to take a more moderate approach, but never quite succeeded. This is perhaps the only thing Chrissy Teigen and I have in common. Alcohol was always around, and like a Swiss Army knife, it had so many different functions. I've used it to celebrate, reward myself, dance in public, blow off steam, numb my anxiety, and feel a sense of belonging. Here's how Caroline Knapp put it. I loved the way drink made me feel, and I loved its special power of deflection, its ability to shift my focus away from my own awareness of self and onto something else, something less painful than my own feelings. I loved the sounds of drink, the slide of a cork as it eased out of a wine bottle, the distinct glug-glug of booze pouring into a glass, the clatter of ice cubes in a tumbler. I loved the rituals, the camaraderie of drinking with others, the warming, melting feelings of ease and courage it gave me. I downloaded the audiobook of Quit Like a Woman mostly because I was researching a prohibitionist. I thought this would be a perfect way to connect Carrie's story to contemporary feminist critiques of alcohol. Like Carrie Nation before her, Whitaker believes that any amount of alcohol is destructive. She does make a good case, one increasingly supported by scientists and government health authorities. A panel of scientists published a report last summer that recommended dropping the maximum number of drinks per day for men to the same level as women, just one. In its recent update, the USDA declined to make this change, but they did clarify something. They mean one or two drinks per day, not 7 or 14 per week, which is how many have interpreted the guidelines. In other words, you're not supposed to bank your allotment so that you can have 2 or 3 or 4 drinks at a time. If that's not depressing enough, already this year, scientists have published a couple of studies that warn of the risks of even moderate drinking. Increasingly, researchers believe that the best way to balance the risks against the benefits of alcohol is to qualify as a light drinker. That's 1 to 3 servings a week. And if you don't drink already, the consensus is that you shouldn't start for any reason. I don't agree with all of Holly Whitaker's conclusions, some of which are fairly controversial. But having said that, I began listening to Quit Like a Woman on January 5th, and I haven't had a drink since. When I told a friend this, she said, "I've never thought of you as someone with an alcohol problem." I guess it depends on how you define the word problem. Like the vast majority of heavy drinkers, I don't meet the clinical criteria for alcohol addiction. But by any standard, I've been drinking too much. And Holly Whitaker reminded me of the consequences of that. It feels premature to declare that I've quit drinking for good. I am fond of the Oscar Wilde quip, "Moderation in all things, including moderation." Except, remember, I haven't been so great at that. I'll leave it at this. For the first time, quitting entirely feels like something I could do if I want to. And for the first time, it feels like that might not be the worst thing in the world. A few days after my last drink, I downloaded Sober Time from the Google Play Store. The app allows you to upload your own background image to its home screen, where it lists the number of years, months, days, hours, and even seconds of sobriety. I scrolled through my recent photos and selected the one I thought was most appropriate to this context. That's why my Sober Time background is an image I captured on my visit to Medicine Lodge, a portrait of foremother Carrie A. Nation. Thanks for listening to Feminist Foremothers, a Mama Film podcast. Feminist Foremothers is written and hosted by Emily Christensen, produced by Emily Christensen and Alila Med-O'Connor, and edited by Kylie Brown. You can find me on Twitter at @ShmemilyEmily. Shmemily is spelled S-C-H-M-E-M-I-L-Y. Find additional Feminist Foremothers content and read our show notes on Mama Film's website, mama.film. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends, and I hope you'll join us for our next 2 episodes. Thanks for listening, and have a smashing day.